The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, and Chicago. And if you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Tim. Nice days we're having.
Fabulous days.
But there's more evidence of fall every day. The equinox is tomorrow. Did you know that?
Yes.
Oh, you did. That's because you're smart.
No, I just paid attention to it. That's
I knew
all.
You'd say that. So, 51.115 kilometers in 1 hour.
Yep.
He did it. Jens Voigt of Germany ended his career on Thursday afternoon by smashing the old hour world record. I thought that was pretty damn impressive.
Yeah.
What a beautiful facility. Did you see the velodrome?
Yeah, pretty
it's
cool bike,
gorgeous.
Too.
Gorgeous. So I can't even imagine who's going to try to break this record.
Maybe Taylor Finney.
Ooh. Now, isn't that a good idea?
Yep.
All right, Taylor, the gauntlet is down, right? Well, we'll see. Okay, so I guess we should move on with the show, yes? Because we have a lot of stuff going on this week.
Yep.
Most of you know I've been in the bike business in Northeast Ohio for like 4 decades. And when I think back on the kinds of things that promoted cycling, whether it was a competition or some advocacy, I could pretty much count everything combined on one hand, literally, in the first 2 or even 3 decades. So the progress we've made in just the past couple of years since we've been hosting the show, since 2010, is just mind-boggling. This evening, we're going to welcome back the director of Bike Cleveland, Jacob Van Sickle. Jacob and the organization Bike Cleveland have done some pretty remarkable things in the past couple of years. And next weekend, a brand new event, NEO Cycle. Are you going to be doing any of the events for NEO Cycle?
No, I won't be doing, but I'm sure I'll be spectating.
Anyway, it's billed as an urban cycling festival consisting of competitive races and unique rides connected by live entertainment. It's an action-filled festival at Cleveland Metro Park's Edgewater Park on the shores of Lake Erie. Now, years and years ago, 1984, we did our check-in for the very first Emerald Health Triathlon at that same park.
Wow.
Yeah, been a few years. Nothing like it, though, has been done in the past. We're going to ask Jacob about the events, what Bike Cleveland and the cycling community at large might expect, and how to get more information. We're also going to talk with Bert Van Beers. He's the co-owner of the Cleveland Heights Spinga Flows. So Spinga Flows offers spinning and yoga classes. They are what is called a root sponsor of the NEO Cycle Fondo Ride. Now, we know about Gran Fondo.
Right.
This is Gran Fondo.
Of course.
I think it's going to be really cool. As the name implies, it is going to be fun. In fact, there are a lot of folks I know who are planning to do that ride, and I thought maybe you were. Moving on. So, you know, we have a Rays indoor mountain bike park here.
Yeah.
It was the very first indoor mountain bike park, right?
Yeah, it's awesome. I was there first year it opened up.
Cool. There are other mountain bike parks that have been created all over the country since, yes? Well, this weekend I learned that the most ginormous mountain bike park to date is going under construction underground. Do you know about this?
No, I don't.
You didn't read about this?
I missed this one.
You get all this news and I actually got something up on you. Okay, turns out that there are millions of square feet of space under the Louisville, Kentucky Zoological Park.
Wow.
A guy named Joe Preisel knows just how to turn a lot of that space into an indoor cycling adventure park. And we're going to ask him how and why.
I'm wondering if maybe that sounds like something we could do in the salt mines here in Cleveland.
Uh-huh. and be really salty. That's blech, blech. No, I don't think so. But this is really cool. They are already having other things going on down there. It's something like 4 million square feet. And the mountain bike park is going to be something like 350,000 square feet. It's going to be huge, huge. And then finally, we're going to talk with author and race expert Richard Moore. His best-selling book, Slaying the Badger, and Tour de France 100, which we renewed last year, are now joined by his newest book, A Top, 20 Great Stages from the Modern Tour de France. So each chapter highlights brand new interviews with riders in the era Richard defines as 1971 and forward to pretty much current day Tour de France. Stories were really fascinating, not only for the race history, but for the human interest stories that emerge, which might never otherwise be told. Stuff that you just, it's really a good book. We'll try to squeeze in a bit of news. So let's get right to it. We're going to talk with Jacob Van Sickle and Bert Van Beers about NEO Cycle Cleveland. Hello, Jacob. Hello, Bert. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Hello, Diane.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you back, Jacob. Things are good?
Yeah, it's always great to be back.
Yeah. It's good to be somewhere, huh?
Right.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about NEO Cycle, and everybody's talking about NEO Cycle. There are big banners up at Edgewater Park. I want to know more about the event and how people can participate. Give us a little history about how NEO Cycle started and what it is.
Yeah, so NEO Cycle was an event that came out of a few collaboration meetings that Bike Cleveland had with the Metro Parks and the Greater Cleveland Sports Commission, and out of that idea came the concept that the Sports Commission has always had is, what can we do to really raise events in Cleveland that draw a regional audience and bring people to Cleveland to experience some of the great assets we have? And certainly with the growth in cycling over the past few years, it became the one we decided to pursue.
And so it is next weekend, September 26th, 27th, and 28th. How's it going to kick off? What's going to happen? I guess that's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, yeah?
Yeah, so it'll kick off, NEO Cycle will kick off on Friday with a small reception at Ray's Indoor Mountain Bike Park. And then on Saturday, there'll be an area called The Hub at Edgewater Park that'll be full of activities, everything from pinball to a temporary Ray's Indoor Mountain Bike course. And then that Saturday, there'll also be cyclocross races, and in the evening, there'll be a night ride that'll actually go on the Shoreway. And then on a Sunday, there is the Forest City Fundo, which is organized by Bike Cleveland. Sponsoring groups are Spinga Flows and Squire Patton Boggs. And there's also a Criterium race on Sunday as well over in Wade Oval. And the one thing I did forget, on Friday, actually, there's track racing over at the Cleveland Velodrome as part of NEO Cycle as well.
Wow. Let's talk to Bert for a second. So, Bert, you are the co-owner of Spinga Flows over on Coventry. How did you get involved with NEO Cycle, and tell us a little bit about Spinga Flows and what its participation is.
Wow. Well, 4-6 months ago, I first saw some publication or some, maybe it was a Facebook post about NEO Cycle, and I thought to myself, what a great opportunity for the brand, Spinga Flows. I contacted the folks at NEO Cycle, expressed some interest, said, what can we do? We had some conversations, and we came upon an agreement. We are a supporting partner of NEO Cycle in general, and like Jacob said, we are also a supporting partner for the 62-mile Metric Century Fundo.
Oh, so you're doing the long route?
We're doing the long route.
Cool. You'll get to see a whole bunch of people we know, because a lot of people are doing that route. Now, are you going to be out there?
My plan is to be out there, yes.
Cool.
Yeah.
Real briefly,
absolutely.
Tell us about Spinga Flows real quick, and then we're going to go right back to NEO Cycle. I know you're on Coventry, and you offer spinning and yoga, kind of an interesting combination.
Yeah, it's a great combination. It's something that originated, in Toronto and came to Cleveland 5 years ago through a couple evolutions of the studio. It is, like you say, it's kind of a natural combination. It's a good combination for both yoga practitioners as well as cyclists, very hand-in-hand. We're finding that the yogis with exposure to cycling really take to that nicely, and vice versa. The cyclists who, myself included, discovered yoga, and it's a very nice way to recover from a ride to supplement your well-being.
Jacob, let's get back real quick and talk about this Fundo. So it's a twist on the Gran Fondo. Tell me why it's different from a Gran Fondo.
So our Forest City Fundo is different from a Gran Fondo in that it's an untimed ride. It's more of a social ride that has mass starts for the different routes. It's meant to be more fun, less competitive, kind of ride at your own leisure, spend time at the rest stops, experience the neighborhoods that you're riding through. So that's why we decided to call it the Fundo, because we're hoping people will certainly have a lot more fun.
So you've got three distances?
Yes, there's a 10-mile family route that's sponsored by Squire Patton Boggs.
It all starts and ends at the hub at Edgewater?
Yep, all of the rides start and end at the hub at Edgewater.
Okay.
And then there's a 32-mile route and a 62-mile route, like what you said, is sponsored by Spinga Flows.
People who know Cleveland know it's east or west. Edgewater Park is technically on the west side. Where are the routes heading?
So for the Fundo, the family ride will focus primarily downtown and near west side. The 32-mile route will go far east and then come back to the west Edgewater. And the 62-miler will go far east, south, and then far west, and then back up to Edgewater.
You know, this was an idea that we had so many years ago. It's so nice to see it really happening. It's very exciting. Tell our audience, our listeners, how they can find out about NeoCycle.
Yeah, so you can learn more about NeoCycle at the website neocycle.org. You can learn about all the races and activities taking place. There is a fee to participate in all the races, but it's free to come down to the hub and kind of experience the activities going on there. So we encourage people to come down. There'll be live music, food, beer, plenty of activities. You know, for us, it's just an exciting time to be on a bike in Cleveland, and having, you know, what we're dubbing the Midwest's largest urban cycling festival is exciting.
Well, I have to say, Jacob, I am just proud to be part of the Cleveland cycling community. You guys are doing a great job, and thanks so much. I know you're ready for a planning meeting and you need to get out of here, so thanks for joining me, and have a really good event next week. I'll see you down at the hub.
Sounds great. Thanks.
All righty. And Bert, thank you very much for being with us tonight, too. We're going to take a very quick break. We will be right back, and we will be talking with Joe Preisel about indoor mountain. It's funny that they mentioned Ray's Mountain Bike Park, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
Because guess what? The guy who actually built that is the guy who's going to talk to us next. We'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist. Hi, Joe. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. You want to talk about mountain bike parks?
I do.
You seem to be the guy who knows. Tell me about your work at Ray's right here in Cleveland. Are you from here?
I am from Cleveland, born and raised in Parma. Started riding bikes back when I was 12 years old, and my mom took me to all the BMX contests and freestyle events, and it turned into a career, really. It turned into me competing professionally in BMX and then mountain biking and then also building stuff, because I just like to build stuff to jump my bike off of.
Because you're still 6 years old.
I am. Well, maybe seven. I'm feeling a little old, so maybe seven.
I think it's awesome. I think it's just great. How did you get hooked up with Ray's? Is that's where you started this interesting career of building mountain bike parks?
Yeah. I met Ray just out of the blue. I went in, heard about his facility he was doing, and I went in, and we became friends, and I started helping, and then he brought me on board, and you know, I helped him build a lot of the stuff he didn't really know about. He built all of the mountain bike stuff and some of the jumps and everything, but we added the skate park style stuff and a lot of the flow stuff that I helped with. And it was great because Ray is an incredible builder, and he builds all kinds, and he rides cross country, so he builds everything for the people that ride that type of stuff, all the skinnies and everything. He knows what that's all like. I ride that too, but my passion is the freestyle and the jumps and the tricks and stuff like that. Worked for him for for quite a while, and then, you know, I wasn't in a very super good place in my life, and I just wasn't happy, and I knew I wanted to do something on my own and just make a break for it, you know?
Yeah, sure. So did you head then out for the West Coast?
I did. I got an offer to build a bike park in Portland, Oregon, and I went, and it just happened to be that the girl I was dating at the time, still dating, and have a child with and married.
So now she's your wife. That's the official way we usually couch those things, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So she was actually from Portland, and all her family was there, so we were off. We just packed everything up and went to Portland, and I became part of the lumberyard and started building there, and throughout Raise and the lumberyard and before Raise, I'd always been going out and building. You know, I helped work with the X Games and the Vans Triple Crown, which is now the Dew Tour. I didn't work for the Dew Tour, but before it was the Dew Tour, that's when I helped a lot. And Woodward, just a huge summer camp for kids for bikes, skateboarding, and everything.
We've talked to them. We've actually had them on the show.
Right.
Yeah, the Woodward Camp. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. So I think every guy who likes dirt and tractors and digging would love your job, right? Do you have the best job?
I do. I could, in a way that, like, I don't treat it as a construction job or a building job. It's more like if I was going to go paint or draw a picture, it's more art for me, I guess.
Why not?
So it's fun. I don't have to. I can change it if I want. I can scrap it if I want. I can just make something up and see if it works. If it doesn't work, tear it down, and I'm not upset about it. I just, you know, I treat it as a learning experience, and you know, I have a big. Big thought that I'm going to be learning until the day I die, I hope.
I think that's a very good way to look at it. So I read this, I think it was in Bicycle Retailer, about this unbelievable project. First of all, how many people have 4 million square feet of space underneath their city that they're using for something in like this cavern-type atmosphere? Tell us about this project underneath the Louisville, Kentucky Zoological Park.
Well, it is massive. I didn't even know stuff like this existed.
Exactly.
They had reached out, or someone reached out to them about doing a bike park, and then they started doing their research. And they found out about my place up in north of Seattle. It's all dirt, so they wanted to come and check it out. So they came out and checked it out, and we just started talking, and they said, you know, if you want any help, that's fine. Like, I can help you out. You know, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard. Like, I would love to be a part of it. And they instantly said, well, if you want to be a part of it, that you're who we want to build it. But we didn't think you did that anymore since you have your own place. And I was like, I'm ready. Let's do it. So, you know, I've been to Louisville twice already. Once for getting to know the job and making sure it was something I wanted to do and meeting everybody. And then I went back again and started the design work and the layout. And this Monday I go back for three months to build it.
I'm speaking with Joe Preissel, and he is building this new, is there a name for the new mountain bike park in Louisville?
Yeah, it's basically the Louisville Mega Cavern. That's their business.
Oh, they own that whole 4 million square feet.
Yes. They have zip lines, ropes course. They have, storage units, all kinds of stuff in this cavern. And it's all part of the Mega Cavern. That's the official name. But they have what's called the Mega Zip Course, the Mega Rope Course. They'll have the Mega Bike Park. So everything will be pretty mega.
Mega is right. So I think I read that it's 350,000 square feet you're planning for the bike park?
Yeah, that's for phase one. So phase one is basically an underground trail network with elevation. So you'll have climbs, descent, jump lines, slope style lines, a BMX style jump line, all that. 40 plus trails in this 350,000 square foot area. And then the other phases that we're talking about is a huge, maybe, you know, 50,000 square foot room inside there that will be a solely a dirt jump park where it's just packed to the walls with dirt jumps and the freestyle jumps. And then another equally sized room that's going to be like a school where you can go and sign up for a class and they can teach you how to ride a bike. They can teach you how to jump a bike. We're going to make all kinds of stuff like, you know, a mulch landing jump and, you know, all the little skinny stuff to learn your balance and a couple pump tracks. It's going to be huge. I still am in awe, and I leave to build it in 4 days.
How long do you think it will take to do phase one to get it ready, and when is projected opening?
Phase one will be done and open and rideable by January 1st.
Wow. You do not have a lot of time there, buddy.
Nope. We are moving fast. I have an amazing crew that I have working with me, and we work together really well. We have already sat down and planned it out. We know exactly all the dirt is being dumped. We did that already. So the dirt is being dumped where we need it, and it's just going to be shaping it and building the trails. The good thing is that it's primarily a mountain bike trail system. So it is basically going to be the first ever indoor bike park geared toward a 5-inch travel bike.
Wow.
So, you know, most parks are built for BMX bikes and hardtails and right. dirt jumpers. This is totally geared for the trail riders and the all mountain riders and the slope style riders. And, you know, I wish it had more elevation because it could be downhill, but there's not as much elevation as I would like.
How high is it? I mean, what kind of ceiling height do you have?
Well, the ceiling height varies from 25 feet to 80 feet.
Okay. Okay.
So all in the different caverns. But the whole system is on an angle going down.
Got
it. Because they were mining down into the ground.
Sure, that makes
so,
sense.
So, I mean, if you look basically at a giant quarry that's outside.
Right.
It's basically that, but underground. So you can go, like, just picture riding down the side of a quarry. It's pretty good elevation.
Yeah, I guess.
So,
okay, I have to ask this question. How much dirt was dumped? Do you know?
So the way the dirt works is they're getting about 50 loads of dirt a day. And since they have their little facility where they're a dump site for clean dirt for the whole city, so every contractor dumps their dirt in the mega cavern.
Got it.
Anyway, so they've been getting dirt for the past 20 years.
Wow. And they'll never fill it up, will they?
Nope. And it's unlimited amount of dirt. I couldn't even think. There's some rooms that are 80-foot tall ceilings that are now only 15-feet tall ceilings. They've actually completely filled certain rooms all the way.
Will there be any foliage? Will there be any trees or grass or anything like that? It's just all dirt.
So I'm working with them on the artistic side as well of how can we make this appealing to someone who wants to be outside. And we came to the point where you can't. We can't have grass, it'll die. We can't have trees, it'll die. We could put fake trees in there.
Nah.
But what we're doing is there's all kinds of abandoned mine equipment from the 1900s, like 1912 is when they started mining it. So there's all this old mining equipment buried, and we're digging it up and moving it in and making it stuff to ride over, ride around.
Okay, that's so cool.
And, like, all the entrances will be, like, any over and unders will look like mine shafts that you ride into. It's going to be, people are going to freak because they just think you're going to go, they're going to be amazed by it's a cave, and then all of a sudden they're going to be like, oh my gosh, there's all this machinery that is old and beat and has never been moved, and we're riding over it or next to it. It's going to be the coolest thing.
Well, you know what? This is just one of the coolest projects I've talked to anybody about in a long time, and I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me about it. How can people find out more about it?
They can go to check it out at the Mega Caverns website, and our bike park up here is promoting it as well. So,
and what's the name of your bike park?
It's the Burlington Bike Park.
Got it. And you're up in the state of Washington.
Yes.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for talking with me about the Mega Bike Park. I just think it's an amazing idea. Louisville's not too far from Cleveland, so maybe one day we'll take a little tootle down there.
Well, we will have a little sneak peek, and I will keep you informed.
I would appreciate that. That would be great. You have a great night, and have a safe trip back out to Louisville.
Thanks.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, well, well.
I went to BMXnews.com, and I saw a short video that they have inside.
Of course you did.
And that is a really cool place.
Is it?
That's just...
You want to be six again or seven?
No, I'm okay being where I'm at. But no, and the neat thing is it's a 10-minute ride from the airport, from the Louisville airport.
Oh, even better.
So,
that's right. I did read that.
Yeah.
But the zoo, for some reason, is really close to the airport.
Quick and easy to go in there. And I've been to Ray's Mountain Bike Place, and that's an awesome place inside.
Well, I guess Joe has all these ideas. I like the idea that they're using all that mining equipment. You know, it's like reuse, recycle, repurpose.
Yeah.
Very cool. We need to take a quick break. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be back with the news and our interview with Richard Moore right after this.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we got some time for news, Mr. McKenna. What you got?
That's always a good thing. Well, remember we did a story about in Ottawa, they work for the police department, the deputy chief, something like that, who happened to, she was the deputy chief.
She got doored,
police
as
chief.
I remember.
She got doored.
Yes.
Right. So because of that story that was out, not from us, but in general from that story, there was an Ottawa cyclist who came out who's been riding around with his helmet cam. And this is what I always talk about. If we don't have a camera, then, you know, we don't see any of it. And it's amazing. There's actually some footage on the ottawa.ctvnews.ca of him riding around and approaching people. And there's actually one where he almost gets doored because of this. And so this is a perfect example of this is why I want to see more cameras on people.
I totally get it. So there are a lot of people who know or knew who Marco Pantani was. And it was a statement that he committed suicide. Well, Velo News this week published a story by Gregor Brown. Italian authorities open homicide investigation into Pantani's death. It comes from Milan. A new investigation into the possible murder of Italian cyclist Marco Pantani took a step forward on Wednesday when Italy's public prosecutor in Rimini handed the case over to the police. In 2004, police determined that the 1998 Giro d'Italia and Tour de France winner had died of a cocaine overdose. Rimini's head prosecutor, Paolo Giovagnoli, I think that's right, said Wednesday, regarding Marco Pantani's death, there's a completely new investigation. He died in Rimini's La Rose Hotel, just 35 kilometers from Cesena on February 14th of 2004. A previous investigation showed that the 34-year-old died of an accidental cocaine overdose. The investigation found three men guilty of supplying the cocaine that killed Pantani. But now, according to recent Italian newspaper reports, Pantani let known men into his room early on the morning of Valentine's Day. The unidentified men hit the cyclist, according to the reports, forced him to drink cocaine diluted in water, carried his body down the stairs of the bi-level room. They allegedly left the room looking disorganized and left Pantani to die. The case was reopened in August after De Renises presented his work and took his first official step forward on Wednesday when Giovagnoli passed it to the judicial police in Rimini. More information is likely to emerge over the coming months as state medical experts examine the assumptions made by Francesco Maria Avato, a legal medical expert the Pantani's hired for its case. I so hope that they find that he did not commit suicide. Not that it'll ever bring him back, but it's such a horrible way to be remembered.
Right.
So I hope you have something a little better.
This is news from California.
This
comes from LodiNews.com. California adds new rule for passing bicycles. Drivers should be extra cautious around bicycles from now on. California has just added the 3 Feet for Safety Act to the California Vehicle Code, and it's effective today. And today is Tuesday, September 16th.
Well, interestingly enough, when I read it, I thought I said 3 feet or more, which was kind of interesting that that was added somewhere.
And this story says it's within 3 feet, so... The new code fines drivers $35 for unsafely passing a bicycle within 3 feet of the cyclist. And a driver who's in a collision with a bicyclist that causes injury and violates this new rule will be fined $220. So when convicted of violating this code, a point will also be added to your driver's license.
Oh.
So the points are important. More
points
more than
are
money.
Important, so long as they actually take the license away when they reach a certain number.
Right.
Right. So our friend, the Secretary of Transportation, Anthony
yes.
Fox,
yep,
he announced a new initiative to enhance pedestrian and bicycle safety this week through a comprehensive approach that addresses infrastructure safety, education, vehicle safety, and data collection. The 18-month campaign will begin with road safety assessments conducted by the U.S. Department of Transportation field offices in every state and will produce multiple resources to help communities build streets that are safer for people walking, bicycling, and taking public transportation. Secretary Fox made the announcement at the Pro Walk, Pro Bike, Pro Place Conference, the largest gathering of transportation engineers, city planners, and professional bicycle pedestrian safety advocates and practitioners in the country. It's quite a long article. It is from the U.S. Department of Transportation. It's a press release, and I think it was on the 14th of September, if I am not mistaken. It was September 10th. I lied. Wednesday, September 10th. I think it's awesome, and I did contact the Secretary's office, and he's going to try and be with us in October. He's booked up for September.
Collegiate cycling.
Yeah.
Marion University to host National Cycling Championships
at
the Major Taylor Velodrome. And this is going to take place the September 25th through the 28th. And this is cycling's largest event. And public is going to have the opportunity to attend for free. Marion University will defend its national championship during USA Cycling's Collegiate Track National Championships against 150 student cyclists representing 30 colleges and universities from around the country. So it's great to see that they'll have this in Marion.
This was probably my favorite story from the week. So I'm in my car, and, you know, I listen to NPR almost. Mm-hmm. NPR or I listen to WJCU because the music's always good.
Yeah.
And I hear them mention the name Brian Cookson.
Okay.
And UCI. And
right.
Of course, my ears perk up. And here's what it was about. Nude or not, women's cycling team uniform makes waves. This is by Bill Chappell on September 15th. This is from NPR. If one goal of the uniforms... I'm sorry. It makes me laugh. The whole thing makes me laugh. If one goal of the uniforms for a women's cycling team from Colombia is to attract attention, they're a smashing success. Some observers are calling the outfits, which in photos seem to feature a swatch of flesh-tone colored fabric in their lower region, nude, wrong, and a disaster. But others are defending the uniform and the cyclists who wear it, saying the criticism is entirely sensationalized. I would say take a look and you tell me what you think. The uniforms made quite a splash in Italy, where the team competed in the elite women's Giro della Toscana this weekend. The race was won by American Shelley Olds, by the way. But people on social media were thrown into a tizzy by the cycling kit of Team Bogota Humana. Contrary to some reports, the team isn't the national squad. Its sponsors include the city of Bogota, and it's endorsed by Colombia's sports ministry. A photo tweeted by Hillary Evans was retweeted more than 11,000 times, and Twitter deemed the image risque enough to warrant a warning that, quote, the following media may contain sensitive material. I'm no fashion expert, but even I know that the Colombia women's cycling team kit seen here is a genuine disaster, Evans wrote. The uniform also drew the attention of UCI President Brian Cookson, who basically said, this will not stand. And it's just the strangest looking. Did you see it?
It was hard not to, because it popped up in the Twitter stream early, right when it happened.
Yeah.
And then through some of the email alerts that I normally get for cycling, I got dozens.
Yeah.
And it even made Huffington Post.
Forget the girls. Nobody's even looking at the pretty faces.
Right.
It's a jersey that kind of bisects the body right above the waist. And then this nude panel all the way down to the thighs. One yellow leg, one red leg. And I'm telling you, it's like you do a double take when you see it.
You know, if they were sponsored by the TSA scanners, I would think there's something funny. But otherwise...
All right. What's your next story?
In the past, we've talked about sponsorship for cycling teams and events.
Right.
And this is from Velo News. Cascade Cycling Classic loses its title sponsor. So America's longest-running road race has recently been put in jeopardy after its title sponsor, Bend Memorial Clinic, BMC, publicly dropped its funding on Thursday. For 9 years, BMC provided financial support to the multi-day Oregon Stage Race. It takes place usually in mid-July. The 2014 event was held June 14th through the 20th, and race organizers have until October 15th to find a title sponsor in order to bring the race back next year.
So, wow. I have one more story, and I'm not going to go into detail, but I was very, very disturbed to learn that Cherokee Shill was arrested again, this time thrown in jail, had to post bond to get out for exactly the same thing riding on the road. Now, using what little tiny bit of influence I have, I contacted a friend of mine who works for NBC. And I am hoping that maybe we'll get some national coverage for what's going on with Cherokee. Because I'm beginning to see it as more than just harassing her. This looks like a real anti-cycling campaign in some ways.
You can't keep doing this to the same person that they know has national exposure. And
that's what I'm hoping.
It being anything more.
Well, and now she has to hire a lawyer again. She's riding on the road. I cannot believe she's doing anything different than she did last time. She's trying to get from point A to point B. It's a 6-lane highway. I just don't understand what the problem is. And maybe I don't understand the whole story. But I'm hoping that somebody else will get to the heart of it who has more influence than little old me.
Right.
Well, we need to move on. We are going to go over to the UK for our interview with Richard Moore about his new book, A Top. Good evening, Richard. Thanks for coming back on the show with me to talk about your new book. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Oh, good. That's good. You know, your books get a lot of press in the United States. I don't know about in Europe, but Slaying the Badger is still one of the top-selling books here. We did review the Tour de France 100 last year. I'm really excited that there's a new one this year. It was just about time for the tour when I received my copy of the book. And since ATOP covers 20 of the greatest stages from the modern tour, I'd like to start with your commentary on this year's tour, the 2014 tour. What did you think of it?
I thought it was a great race. I was there. I think, you know, it was interesting to consider it with regards to this book and whether any of the stages would merit a place in a future, you know, volume of greatest ever stages. And I think definitely stage 5 over the cobbles was one of the great stages of the tour. We saw Chris Froome crash out, of course, and that that was just the headline of the day. But there was so much that went on in that stage. That's probably where Vincenzo Nibali laid the foundations for his win. And I think even if Froome and Contador had stayed in the race, I think it would have been difficult for them to beat him because of the advantage that he built up on that day. So that was a cracking stage. And it was a shame that we didn't see that three-way battle between Contador, Froome and Nibali. But I really enjoyed the emergence of the young French riders, Romain Bardet and Thibaut Pinot, both of them challenging for the podium. I thought that was great. It was a great subplot to the race. So lots of things to enjoy.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. And there seemed to be a lot of different stage winners. It was kind of, you know, not a one-man race, but it was just really a fun race to watch this year. How do you think overall the Tour was stacked up against, say, some of these great stages you did and the 100? Do you think it would like shine as a special race this year, or do you think it would just kind of somewhere be in the middle?
It's hard to tell when you're in the race or you're in the immediate aftermath of it. You need a little bit of time to reflect, I think. But I do know that there were very few, if any, boring stages. Even a stage that looked boring and straightforward on paper, the stage that Jack Bauer almost won, Alexander Kristoff overhauled him in the final 10 metres. That was a thrilling stage. And, you know, Jack Bauer's story from that day is fascinating. And so every day threw up some kind of interesting narrative. And, you know, you do get perhaps you focus overwhelmingly on who's in the yellow jersey and that battle for the overall. But, you know, beneath that, there are so many other stories, which is kind of what I wanted to show in Étape. Often the story is not just about the context of the race. There's something exceptional that happens that day, or it can be misfortune or struggling to stay within the time limit or a solo escape that doesn't come to anything. You know, there are always at the Tour every day numerous interesting stories, and a lot of them, most of them, don't get told.
Yeah, which is what's so fascinating about your book. So Étape, it's 20 great stages from the modern Tour de France. For the purpose of this book, define modern for us. What years are you covering here?
Hey, color television. I extended it a little bit because I started off when I originally sat down with an editor and spoke about the idea. I wanted to just cover stages that I had seen, so either on TV or in person. I wanted to just cover stages that I had kind of lived through. But as I went on, there were one or two others that stood out for me. One was Eno's victory over the cobbles in 1980. I was glad I included that given the cobbled stage this year. And also Freddie Martins was somebody whose path I had crossed a couple of times, and so I was keen to include him in the book. And I also had the opportunity when I was in Qatar to interview Eddie Merckx, and I didn't feel I could not include Eddie Merckx.
So, I should think not.
I made a bit of an exception for Merckx, because in the chapter on Merckx it's actually three stages, so I've called that chapter Trilogy. I broke my own rules in places, but the earliest stage is 1971 and Merckx. I think going further back, what was absolutely crucial and key for me in this book was to do new interviews with the protagonist or protagonists or just some players in the stage. And if you go further, the further back you go, the harder it is to get interviews with people and to get reliable interviews with people, shall we say.
Sure.
People's memories, obviously.
Sure.
Start to fail them a little bit. So that was the reason for that self-imposed kind of criteria.
And one of the things that you made very clear was that these needed to be new interviews. Did anybody give you a lot of grief about doing an interview? Was there anybody who you wanted to include who you weren't able to include in this book?
Actually, only one, and that was Sean Yates.
Really?
For some reason, Sean Yates refused to do an interview with me for the book. I don't know why, but he didn't want to do it. I wanted to include his time trial stage in 1988. It was quite early. In the end, I'm glad he did, actually, because I don't think that was necessarily as interesting a story as the ones I eventually included. There were one or two interviews I did intending to include them in the book, and I didn't in the end. But yeah, Sean Yates, I tried quite hard to get Martin Early, who's the kind of forgotten Irishman from the 1980s, early 90s. You know, we had Roach and Kelly, but Martin Early was the sort of third Irishman, and tried to get an interview with him, and he did say he would do it, but I found him incredibly hard to pin down in the end. It didn't happen. So, yeah, those were the only two, really, who I did try and ultimately failed to interview.
Interesting. I want to focus just for a second on one chapter, which really kind of caught my attention, you know, as I look through the table of contents, and all of the people in the book are so interesting. But chapter 14 is titled The Unknown Warrior, about a guy by the name of Jose Luis Viejo from the 1976 tour. There seems to be an official story. And then there's a real story. So what are the two stories about him?
Yeah, that's interesting. I should have mentioned that one as well, because that's another one that goes that sort of predates my watching of the tour. But I became interested in that story because there's a fantastic book called The Great Bike Race by Geoffrey Nicholson, who is a sort of pioneering cycling writer in the UK, and he covered the tour for many years, and he wrote this great book, which is out of print now, called The Great Bike Race, and it was just about the 1976 Tour de France. And he doesn't spend a lot of time talking about this stage. He sort of glosses over it, but in fact Viejo set a record that day for the biggest ever margin of victory by a solo rider. He won by over 22 minutes, and in the book it is explained that Viejo was allowed to get away because his team was in trouble. They hadn't won anything. Their sponsors were threatening to pull out. And essentially, Nicholson suggests it was a gift from Freddie Martins, actually, and other riders in the race, and other teams in the race. So I went to interview Viejo, and that wasn't his version of events at all. Connected to Geoffrey Nicholson's telling of the story, though, is the fact that he talks in the book about, on that particular day, a few of those journalists raced ahead and stopped for coffee, and they actually missed a lot of the action. They missed the early attack, and they didn't know what was going on. So it highlighted as well some of the challenges that journalists faced throughout history, still even to this day, even with the technology that we have now, to cover, to report accurately what has gone on in the race. You know, an awful lot of things happen that you don't see, or you don't necessarily know why a certain team will be chasing, or when a certain rider attacks and who with, and why it works or doesn't work, etc., etc. And you can only find out these things really by speaking to the guys in the peloton. And even then, you know, some of those guys don't know what's going on and why. So all these multiple narratives going on. But, you know, I felt reading that version that Geoffrey Nicholson told of the Echo's win, that Viejo might well have a different version, and so he did. You know, he basically rubbished a lot of what Geoffrey Nicholson claimed in his book, as you might expect that he would. You know, he obviously wants to show his win in a more positive light. But it just, for me, it wasn't so much proving that Geoffrey Nicholson got the facts wrong. It was more to highlight how difficult it was, and still to some extent remains, to accurately report sometimes what goes on in a stage. And Viejo himself was interesting for me because he was a very obscure rider who I hadn't even heard of, didn't have many results on his Palmarès. That's definitely his best result. But you know, he was a decent rider who sort of slipped into obscurity when he retired. And it was fun to sort of dig him back up and allow him to tell his story, I suppose.
I'm speaking with Richard Moore. He is the author of several books. We have interviewed him before, talking about the Tour de France 100. He's the author of Slaying the Badger and his new book, A Top 20 Great Stages from the Modern Tour de France. Really an interesting book, lots of fun chapters. I want to go back to something you said about journalists, because it was brought up in another book that I'm reading, Road to Valor, about Gino Bartali.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting book because of its history and because of some of the things he did during World War II. But more importantly, it's about how journalists are so – how journalism has changed so much. Because back in the early tours, you know, you had newspapers who were reporting the tour. You had a little bit of radio. You had – the communication was so different. And somebody said last week, I think it was on the show, that today's journalists are just not the same as they were then. Do you feel the reporting on races today is as good or better than what it was, say, when there wasn't this internet and this instant communication?
Well, it's probably more accurate.
That's
true. Think, you know, in France especially, I think, and to some extent in Italy, a tradition did grow up of very flowery, descriptive writing about bicycle racing. And often that could be because the journalist, who a lot of the times was also a novelist or a playwright or a poet, that those were the kind of people that covered cycling back then, was using all, you know, the limits of his imagination to convey what went on, because, as I said earlier, they didn't know a lot of the time what had gone on, and a race report could be as much a work of the imagination as a factual piece of writing. I think that's what we're kind of led to believe now. I mean, you know, without TV cameras following it all, and how on earth could you know what was going on? You were reliant on one or two or three or four sources from the peloton who would tell you what happened. But how reliable were their memories? You know, how did they know distance covered when so and so attacked, or you know, the gap that certain rider had at a certain point? So, you know, I think they were, the stage reports back then were pieced together from, you know, what few facts that you had, and the rest of it was probably quite embellished, I would imagine. So there'd be great scope for the writer to really allow his imagination to run riot. It must have been great fun.
It does sound like fun, actually. And you get to actually practice your trade, writing, which is kind of fun.
Yeah. These days, we don't know everything that goes on, but you do, you know, with race radio and TV cameras, you know, covering the whole stage of the Tour de France, you have a very good idea, you know, of who attacks when and what happens at what particular points in the race. So, you know, there are fewer excuses for getting things wrong now.
True, I guess. Well, probably, and we still probably get some things wrong.
Still do get things wrong, absolutely, yeah.
So the Vuelta just wound down, and that leads me to one of your chapters, the Stage 17 in the 1984 Tour with Bernardino and Luis Herrera. You titled it Guerrilla Warfare. Explain that.
Well, that was actually a description given to that stage by Robert Miller, who was writing it, and he described the battle between Fignon and Eno, who were battling for the yellow jersey, as guerrilla warfare. They were just attacking each other relentlessly. Eno especially was just, you know, going mad that day and attacking all over the place. And it was Luis Herrera who slipped away and won, the first ever Colombian stage winner. And so the guerrilla warfare title is a sort of reference also to, you know, what we think of when we think of Colombia sometimes, perhaps unfortunately, but you know, a sort of postscript to the chapter, and I cover it in the chapter, is that Herrera was kidnapped by guerrillas several years later when in retirement. He was released after a couple of days, and apparently his captors quizzed him relentlessly about his cycling career, which was interesting. He was a huge star in Colombia. So it kind of worked on two levels, that chapter title, but it was anarchic, and it was, and you know, a lot of the stages from the 80s, I think, in particular, were, they did have that, they weren't controlled, the sort of controlled affairs that we have now. They were anarchic and quite wild.
Every chapter has such interesting things that you don't think of when you think of the Tour. You know, we see the Tour and we see sort of this overall 21 stages, which brings me to the question why the book has 20 chapters, not 21. It just seemed a little ironic to me.
Yeah, you're right. But actually, it has 21 stages covered in it, because one of those chapters is a rest day.
Is a rest day. Okay, very good. That's right. Oh!
One of the chapters covers a rest day, and one of the chapters includes three stages. So my maths is not very good, but...
it's not that bad.
that means 21 stages plus a prologue, because... and that's often what the Tour has, I think, isn't it? 21 stages plus a prologue. I mean, it varies sometimes. There are some tours that have had more, some tours that have had fewer stages. But, 21 stages plus a prologue. That I have to say, that's kind of accidental. I just reached 20 chapters and felt I had the right number. I didn't want to include a stage for the sake of including a stage. You know, I felt 20 was a nice round number. And in the ballpark of a Tour de France.
Sure. So do you have a favorite interview from this book? Again, these are all new interviews. So is there an interview in there that just kind of blew you away?
I mean, there's a few surprising ones. You know, I think the most enjoyable in a way was Claudio Chiappucci, the Italian climber from the 90s, just because he's such a outrageous character and so Italian and such a cliche in a way. But, you know, I enjoyed going and interviewing him and telling the story. Freddie Martins is somebody who you know, is an entertaining, quite bizarre character. And, you know, there were surprising ones like Bobby Julich, who I interviewed for the 1998 chapter, the Stage de Les Deux Alpes, where Marco Pantani won the stage and Bobby Julich thought he was riding into the yellow jersey and, as it turned out, wasn't. But his interview was fascinating because I didn't think he, since his confession that he had used EPO in that tour, I don't think he'd really spoken about that stage and that race. And so it was very interesting to get his perspective on it with that secret out the bag. You know, there was no hiding from that. But strangely, you know, his explanation of how it felt to be in that tour and be under siege from the police throughout and to have this secret weighing on him was all very interesting. But actually, it was one or two tiny little vignettes that I found most fascinating talking to Bobby Julich. One of them being about a Tag Heuer watch which he was given by Jan Ullrich, which I thought was just a wonderful little tale. I'll not tell it now, but just some interviewees have this capacity for remembering the smallest details, and those small details are often the most telling. So I got a lot out of the Bobby Julich interview.
How long did it take you to put this book together?
About a year. You know, I maybe started a few interviews before then, sort of late 2012, but for most of 2013 I worked on it.
Well, it's a delightful book. Again, it's A Top 20 Great Stages from the Modern Tour de France by Richard Moore. Are you working on a new one now?
Yeah, I am working on a new book. It's not a cycling book, the next one, I'm afraid to say. Sorry about that, but I'm sure once I've done this next one, and I think this next one will nevertheless appeal to cyclists, I hope so anyway. It's an athletics book about the Jamaican sprinters, Usain Bolt and co.
That sounds interesting.
I hope so. But the book after that, I'll go back to another cycling book. There's still a lot more. And, you know, if Etape does well, perhaps there'll be an Etape Volume 2. Who knows?
Sure, because there are more than just 21 stages of the tour that were interesting over these many years. Well, Richard, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me about your new book. It is available from Velo Press here in the States. And I don't know, how do you distribute your books in the UK?
UK, well, it's published by HarperCollins in the UK, and it's available in all good bookshops and others as well.
Well, thank you. Have a wonderful evening, and we'll talk again.
Thank you, Diane.
All right.
Nice to speak.
Nice to speak to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Richard Moore joined me from his home in England. Always interesting. He has all these details that he can remember. We're going to wind our show up with that interview today. I hope you enjoyed it. We will be back next week with another full show. We've got a lot of cool people on tap for this coming week and for the fall and going on into the holidays. If you have a chance, I hope you're able to go for a ride. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.